this special edition of the Fremantle Press podcast. Today we are recording in Wallyallup in Whadjuk Noongarrbuja, and I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. This is a place of Bulubare, many stories, and I'd like to also acknowledge our First Nations peoples as the first storytellers right across Australia and possibly across the world. My name is Helen Milroy and I love kids' books. I'm also an author and illustrator, and I love hosting this podcast because we get to talk to fabulous and interesting people about their books. Today we're going to be speaking with Catherine Lefroy. Catherine writes novels, screenplays and articles. Her stories have appeared on screens, big and small, in magazines and journals and online. She holds a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Melbourne and a PhD from Monash University. Catherine has lived in many wonderful cities around the globe, considers cheese a primary food group, and not so secretly wishes she lived in a dance movie. Her debut novel, Alex and the Alpaca Save the World, was shortlisted for the 2020 Premier's Prize for Writing for Children. And the sequel, Alex and the Alpacas Ride Again, proves to be just as thrilling. So, Catherine, just a few questions about yourself to get started. Are you a local? Did you grow up here?
I am a local, yes. I grew up in Western Australia, in South Fremantle. But I left as soon as I finished high school. I was out of here, and I've spent a long time living in other parts of Australia and all over the world. And then actually almost 2 years ago to the day, I landed back in Western Australia for what was supposed to be a 3-week vacation, and have stayed here because it's quite a gorgeous part of the world.
Oh, absolutely agree with you there. And probably one of the safest places to be right now, I imagine.
I know. Yes, it definitely feels like it, doesn't it? We're very lucky.
Very lucky. So, Catherine, did you do much reading as a kid? What was that like for you growing up?
Oh, Helen, you could not get a book out of my hands. So my absolute favourite thing to do on like summer vacations or really any time where I didn't have to be at school, even at school probably, I just had a book in my hands. So for not that we're a particularly religious family, but for Easter, we would get books instead of Easter eggs. For Christmas, always books. For birthdays, books. And I remember my parents telling me that, you know, one year, one Christmas, Father Christmas delivered a stocking of books to me, and my parents were like, this is terrific, that'll keep her in bed for hours. And apparently an hour and a half later I was up and I was like, right, I finished them all, what's next? So yes.
Much to the disappointment of your parents.
I know, they were quite devastated actually. And I still love reading. Like I read anything and everything. You know, people usually love, they're like, I love this genre, I love that genre. I put anything in my hands and I will read it. If it's got words, I'm right there. Mm. Yeah. So yes, that is a very long-winded way of saying, yes, I have always loved reading.
So did you have a favourite? Was there one book in particular that at some stage in your growing up years really stuck out for you?
Do you know there is, and I still read it every single year. So it's a book called The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, and it's, oh my gosh. If you haven't read it, I would highly recommend it. It still stands the test of time. It is heartfelt. It's adventure. It's family. It's got baddies. It's got good triumphing over evil. And it's set in, I don't know, industrial age England or something like that. So there's also coal. I don't know why that stood out to me, but there is like lumps of coal in this story, which I think growing up I was like, that is so weird, what is that? But yes, I read that book to this day every year and I still love it every single time. I could probably quote it to you verbatim as well.
What impact did it have on you? What in particular stayed with you?
I think it was the adventure. Like I love a story that's like fast-paced and adventurous, and it was also just this idea of the underdog triumphing over the big, bad, evil. I don't want to give too much away in it. I'm sure a lot of people have actually read it. And that's something that I still love in stories of any kind, you know, films or books or TV shows, just this idea of like one small person triumphing over some big, baddie or evil or something like that.
Sounds like it instilled some kind of hope.
Yeah, that is actually a lovely way of putting it. And I don't think I've articulated it to myself in that way, but I think that is 100% correct. Yeah, because I do. I love, particularly at the moment, I love hopeful stories.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have to be pretty and happy all the time, but I just love leaving audiences and I love being left with a feeling of hope. Like, do you know what? All is not lost. We can actually succeed or triumph. And I think we actually all need a little bit more of that in our lives, particularly, as I said, at the moment.
Absolutely. And I think especially for children, you know, it must be very confusing times for them at the moment. So having hope and that idea that, you know, even as little people, they can do something that's significant. So I think that's a great message to children, isn't it? And to writers, is to have that hope instilled.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, I think that's something that I really tried to get across in my books. I don't know whether I did it consciously or unconsciously, but yeah, showing that one individual person who might not even think that they're that terrific or that amazing or that, but, you know, they might just be like, I'm just average. Like, what can I do? You know what? You can actually do something.
Everyone can make a difference. Catherine, what age did you become interested in actually writing stories?
So I've always been writing. Both my parents are writers. So growing up, we were not allowed to really watch television or do anything like that. We were really encouraged to create rather than consume, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
it does. I mean, books, totally. You can read as many books as you want. But, like, I remember as a kid growing up and, like, we made our own board games and wrote our own stories and illustrated and all of that kind of stuff. So growing up, definitely, and all through school, I did a lot of writing. I think most writers now won writing competitions as a kid. And then I guess when I got to university, I stopped the creative writing aspect. I did actually a creative writing course at college, and I think that, like, honestly killed it a little bit for me. I think once I tried to put that framework of academia around creative writing, it really killed it for me. And so there was a big gap there where I wasn't doing any creative writing. Obviously, I was still writing essays for college. But then it was when I was doing my PhD many years later that I just felt like the creative buzz started in me again. And I started writing a weekly blog that is not appropriate for children at all, but it was like a weekly soap opera that was just like fun and sexy and ridiculous. And it was such a fantastic outlet that I was just like, oh my God, that's right. I love doing this. And I didn't set myself any rules. The only rule I had was like, you have to write an episode in 3 hours. That was it, and release it every week kind of thing. So yeah, I think I've always had the writing bug in me, but it was dormant for probably a decade and then it got reignited. And honestly, Helen, now just you try and stop me writing. Like, ask my husband, I get so grumpy if I have even like 3 days where I'm not creating stories of some kind.
It sounds like you had to find that intuition again and that sort of natural creativity within to get back on that path. And in some respects, you know, academia and the like took you off that natural path.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And when I did start writing again, I actually made a really conscious decision. So when I wrote the first draft of Alex and the Alpacas Save the World, I just sat down and I like vomit drafted out. And it was such a mess. It was like, I look back at it now and I'm just like, I don't know. It's like, there's no sort of narrative structure to whatever. But I did make a very conscious choice that I wanted to sit down and just write something without learning how to write, if that makes sense.
Yeah, without all the filters.
I guess I then circled back and learned my craft. And I'm still learning. I believe you're constantly learning throughout your whole life. But I made a really conscious decision to not learn the craft until I'd actually created something, if that makes sense.
It sounds like you fitted the structure into the creativity rather than fitting the creativity into the structure. And that then gave you a more authentic story at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, gosh, I hope so. It's obviously hard to comment on your own work.
Of course.
This is not to say I don't like structure, because I actually love structure. And a lot of my stories, well, all of my stories follow like a pretty traditional three-act structure or a hero's journey, if anyone's familiar with those terms. Yeah. The thing I like about structure is that it actually does open you up to be very creative within constraints. So I suppose it's not contrary to what I was just saying before, but these days I actually like having a structure in my mind. And that's something that does come quite intuitively to me now after many, many years of practicing it. I like having that structure because it means I can go in and I'm like, right, here's the box I have. Color in however you want inside that box. And having those constraints actually helps me be more creative, I think, these days. I don't think it would have done to start with, but these days it does.
So you started with creativity, you then eventually learned structure, and then at some point you're able to put them together, but you need both is what you're really saying.
I do believe that. I know other people will say differently, but I absolutely believe that. I think as well because I write very commercial stories, and all commercial stories basically fit into a structure of some kind. So yes, I do love commercial structures to frame my stories by these days. Honestly, it's the way you marry them together that will give you your voice or your perspective. It's what's going to make you unique.
Hmm. So Catherine, what's the inspiration behind your books? I'm very intrigued by Alex and the Alpacas.
Ah, yes. Okay, so the first one, I wrote the first draft of it back in, I actually can't remember off the top of my head, but it was quite a while ago. So it's set in Tasmania. I was living in Melbourne and I went to Tasmania for a weekend to meet my then boyfriend's aunt, who was house-sitting an alpaca farm.
Right. I wondered where the alpacas came from.
Yeah, no. Okay, so it was this hobby alpaca farm. So I arrived there. We were supposed to be there for one weekend. It was a bit of a drive from Hobart. It was sort of the middle of Tasmania, Huon Valley. I arrived there and I got out of the car and I just turned to my husband and said, I don't ever want to leave this place. You know, sometimes you arrive somewhere and there's just magic. Like you walk out and you can just feel it's like there's magic. I don't know. It's almost like electricity in the air. So that's how I felt when I arrived at this hobby farm. At this farm, let's just call it a farm. I'd never met my boyfriend's aunt before, but I ended up staying there for 2.5 weeks with her. He went back to Melbourne. I stayed with her. I had no clothes with me really. So we had to go to like a $2 store and I bought a tracksuit that I wore the entire time I was there. And I actually sat down and wrote the first draft of an entirely different book. And I'd never written a book before, so I wrote this like mystery thriller thing that literally is never coming out of the bottom drawer. That was a really terrific practice run for me and how not to write a novel. But I wrote a whole book in 2 weeks and I just thought, well, that was easy, whatever. But being there, I just kept having these ideas of talking alpacas and mystery in the forest and oh, all kinds of like magical, mystical things that just popped into my head. And I didn't actually sit down and write the first draft of Alex for another couple of years, but those ideas would not leave me alone, Helen. Like they were there and they were just saying to me, like, you better do something with us, otherwise we're going to haunt you in your dreams. So eventually I sat down and wrote the first draft and now they do not haunt me in my dreams, which is lovely.
That real experience that you had there was really important then, because that really comes across, that sort of feeling of magic and something mystical in the air, as you say, comes out in the book. Do you think that it would have been impossible to write that without that actual experience?
Absolutely impossible. I never, ever would have come up with the idea for this book if I hadn't been there. And do you know, almost every single one of my stories, I get inspiration from where I am, I suppose, from the landscape. I never come at stories from character first. I always am inspired by the place or the feeling of a place or something like that. Mm. Yeah. So definitely that little tiny pocket of Tasmania, yeah, there was some crazy creative magic going on there. Yeah.
What were you hoping kids would get out of Alex and her alpacas?
I really wanted kids to take away from it the feeling that I got when I was 10 and I sat down to read a book, which was the whole day disappears because you're just so engrossed in a story. I don't necessarily want kids to take away a strong message or anything like that. I just want them to be so engrossed in this story that they can't put it down. And, you know, I've had some terrific emails and messages from parents who, it's a bit of a catch-22, but they're like, thanks so much for the book. My daughter or son loved it. They read it in one day. And part of me is like, wow, that's amazing. So really I've achieved what I set out to achieve. But I'm also like, gee, that took me 7 years to write and they've consumed it in one day. I better get like a bit quicker at writing stories, I think.
Yes, a long time in the making, but very quick to read. However, perhaps in that sort of short time frame for reading, the feeling or the magic, as you say, stays with the child.
Well, I hope so. I mean, this is the best thing about being a kid's author, and you would know this as well. I get like parents will email me drawings that their kids have done based on scenes that from the book or like ideas that they've sparked or animals that they would want to help save the world. And that's it, isn't it? You just want to spark imagination in other people. Curiosity and creativity, that's what runs the world.
Absolutely. Yep. That's maybe what will save the world. Who knows? What do you want the parents to find in your book?
So for the parents, I don't actually sit down when I'm writing and think I am going to write a kid's book. I sit down, well, I actually stand when I'm working. So I stand and I think I want to write a book that I would like to read as an adult that is also appropriate for children.
Okay.
So what the parents take away is, well, number one, they love that their kids are reading. Number two, I've had terrific emails and messages from parents who say, thank you for creating a book that is also enjoyable for us. And the other thing that a lot of people have said is, thank you for making short chapters. So a lot of parents will read it to their kids at bedtime and the kids will be like, just one more chapter. And they're like, oh, okay, one more chapter, because they're quite short chapters. So they can like get through it pretty quickly. So yeah, and you know, I've had a lot of adults say to me, oh yeah, when my kid falls asleep, I actually read ahead because it's engaging and it's engrossing. And do you know the best piece of fan mail I've ever had is a handwritten letter that someone from England posted, a 90-year-old man who said that he read my book and he put down all of his gardening magazines to read my book because it was so engrossing, and he didn't read his gardening magazines for a few days because he was too busy reading my book.
Wow.
And that to me was just the most amazing piece of feedback I'd ever got.
You trumped gardening, my goodness.
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine? I was like, oh my gosh, no pressure. Oof.
So, Catherine, is it difficult to hold in mind the child and the parent as you're writing? Sometimes that can be a hard thing to span across both, particularly given children are at quite a different sort of developmental stage compared to adults. How do you do that?
I honestly don't think about it. Perhaps it says a lot about my maturity level rather than my writing ability. The things I think about is like, obviously, no swearing. I don't like putting romance in these stories because I love the purity of friendship. So I suppose I think about things before I go into writing rather than when I'm actually sitting down writing. Some of the themes are like they're pretty scary. I'd say they're a little edgy for, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 year olds, depending on how developed they are. So again, I'm pushing a couple of boundaries probably in terms of themes and scenes, I suppose, let's call it that.
Certainly complex plots, that's for sure. Obviously kids can run with that, but adults can as well.
So I love Pixar movies, and you look at a Pixar movie and a 5-year-old child can get something out of a Pixar movie, and an 85-year-old grandparent can also get something out of a Pixar movie. So I suppose I'm always thinking, how do I appeal to the broadest audience for want of a better word, I suppose.
And not leaving children out of that, which is a fantastic way of doing it.
There's also so much that you get as an adult from kids' stories, I think, that, you know, the themes are all very similar, and the heart and the characters, like they're all real issues and problems and challenges that we all face. Like it's not an age thing, I don't think.
That's right. They're not unique to adults or children. They're unique across the population. Catherine, you have a PhD. Yeah. You've worked in many different roles, including costume design, marketing, high tech, research, academia, and so on. Do you have a secret twin we don't know about, or are you secretly 120 years old? That's an awful lot to fit in your life already. How did you manage all of that?
This is not necessarily something to be proud of, but I'm a workaholic. I find it very difficult to take time off, and I think I said it before, I love my work so much that I want to just do it all the time, basically.
Do you think all of those other experiences, given that they're quite varied and, you know, even different industries, did that all help with the sort of inspiration with the books and the actual process of writing at all?
Absolutely, 110%. I would be nowhere near as good a writer as I am today. That sounds quite conceited, but I think you know what I mean. As good a writer as I am today, if I hadn't had all of those experiences. Because one of the things that came, that really became clear to me, I suppose the older I got and the more different industries I worked in, was that the thing I loved about everything I did was the ability to tell a story about wherever I was working. So, you know, when I was working in sales, the thing I loved most was like telling a story behind the product. When I was working in marketing, the thing I loved most was like crafting stories and how do we engage people with these stories. And I think, you know, the different types of writing that I do as well. So the screenwriting, the technology writing, the novel writing, all of those things, I take different skills from all of them, and putting them all together just makes me a far, far better storyteller, I think. People often say, write what you know, and I don't necessarily believe that to be true, but I think there's something in this idea of like, write emotions that you know. And I think doing a lot of different things has given me different feelings that I can then bring into my work. I still work on tech projects for Silicon Valley. I'm still screenwriting. So I've got a couple of screenwriting projects that are for kids, but I'm also doing some stuff for adults. So I really do still do a very broad spectrum of writing.
Yeah. Did you have any setbacks with your writing? And if you did, how did you deal with them?
Yes, I did, Helen. Just one or two, you know. Yeah, I know. So many setbacks. How long is this podcast? Look, so many setbacks. But in a nutshell, the publishing industry is difficult. Writing is difficult. It's very difficult to get published. It's difficult to get an agent. It's all hard, right? I have been rejected hundreds of, like, absolutely hundreds and hundreds of times. I've had people say to me, you're really not as good as you think you are. I've had people say to me, don't give up your day job. I'm like, this is my day job. That's awkward. I've had people say all kinds of things. And I just keep coming back to the fact that creative industries are so subjective. So if you get one bad piece of feedback, that does not mean you should give up. That means, if anything, you should work harder to prove that person wrong. That's how I sort of approach it. And also, setbacks just make you a better writer, to be honest. Like, you can't be precious about stuff. You really can't, particularly, I mean, I think you actually maybe need to think about like writing and getting published almost as two separate things, because writing can be just like pure creativity. There are no boundaries on it, right? But if you want to get published, your book is going to have to sell. And so you have to reach an audience. That's part of the way I think about it as well. I'm sorry, I've completely lost track of the question.
I think that's an interesting point, Catherine, because it sounds to me like some of your experiences across your career helped you then deal with the potential for setbacks and understanding that this is part of the process. As you say, not taking it too personally, but using it to drive you forward. Was there one thing in particular that kept up your motivation, or a person or someone in your life or elsewhere that just kept you going? Because I know some people, they get those setbacks and they get that disappointment, and sometimes they go away from writing. What kept you going?
It was a few things. So the first sort of book, I suppose, that I sat down to write in earnest was Alex and Malpaca's Save the World. And it was just this innate belief that there was something in this story, regardless of how many people said, no, don't like it, not for us, you know, da-da-da. I knew inside me that there was just something here, something magical. And I thought, well, if I can feel it, then surely someone else will feel it too. So that was one thing. So it was having, I mean, belief in myself, I suppose. The second thing was surrounding myself with a community of other writers who understood what I was going through, but also who had these wild achievements that in my greatest dreams I never thought would happen to me. I remember before I got published saying to my writers group, if I ever get published, I'm going to die of shock. And you know what? I got published and I did not die of shock.
Thank goodness.
As it turns out. Yeah, thank goodness, right? In a nutshell, it's surrounding yourself with people who are more advanced in their career than you and realizing that they are just people who are just doing the same thing as you. It's just they've got there first. Oh, and then the third thing, very long-winded, I know. The third thing is support. So my husband has just been my greatest cheerleader the whole time. So when I finished my PhD, I had never really told anyone that I wanted to write a book. I had it in the back of my mind. I was like, you know what? I think I have a book in me. And when I finished my PhD, he gave me this little how-to book called How to Write a Novel in 30 Days. And I was like, why are you giving this to me? And he said, I can just tell you've got a story in you that wants to come out. He was my boyfriend at the time. And then I decided I should probably marry him because he understood me quite well. So find someone who's going to cheerlead and pour you champagne when it's needed and cups of tea when they're needed and chocolate when it's needed.
One thing I took away from some of that, apart from obviously clearly having people who believe in you, is that you found the magic, you believed in it, and you weren't going to let it go.
No, I am also quite stubborn. So if I want to do something, it is going to happen, even if it takes 7 to 10 years.
Well done. Well done, Catherine. So any final words for us today, Catherine?
Just keep consuming stories, whatever form they're in, because if you can be a good storyteller, you're going to go places, to be honest. Like, I truly believe the world is built on story.
Absolutely.
And if you can, yeah, if you can engage people in a narrative, regardless of what that is, whether you're a public speaker, a teacher, a bus driver, whatever it is, if you can tell a great story at a dinner party, I just feel like you're going to be surrounded by wonderful people and your life is just going to be a lot richer. Stories make the world a richer place.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more, Catherine. And they're lovely words to finish on. So, listeners, you can find Alex and the Alpaca Save the World and Ride Again in all good bookstores and online at fremantlepress.com.au. If you enjoyed our chat today, subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Helen Milroy and I have been your host today. Join me next time as we continue our journey into everything books.